Welcome to the Allowed Podcast. I'm Louise Steinman, curator of the Allowed series, presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Allowed is a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. To learn more about Allowed and learn how you can help the Library Foundation of Los Angeles support the Los Angeles Public Library, please go to our website, www.alloudla.org. The Allowed program you're about to hear was produced in 2009.
It is my pleasure tonight to welcome our guests, James Bradley and Roger Dingman. James Bradley is the author of the New York Times bestsellers Flyboys and Flags of Our Fathers and the son of one of the men who raised the American flag on Iwo Jima. His newest book, The Imperial Cruise, A Secret History of Empire and War, tells the story of the historic diplomatic mission sent by President Teddy Roosevelt in 1905 to Hawaii, Japan, the Philippines, China, and Korea. In her laudatory recent review in the New York Times, Janet Maslin writes that Mr. Bradley's thesis in The Imperial Cruise is startling enough to reshape conventional wisdom about Roosevelt's presidency. In conversation with James Bradley tonight is Roger Dingman, an emeritus professor of history at the University of Southern California, where he taught American international, naval, and military history for 36 years. Professor Dingman specializes in American East Asian relations with an emphasis on Japan. His latest book is Deciphering the Rising Sun, Navy and Marine Corps Codebreakers, Translators, and Interpreters in the Pacific War. Thank you very much, and I hope you enjoy the program. And now may I introduce our guests.
Okay, I think we have to move these closer.
I think it's my job to start out with doing what Louise suggested should be done, that is to try to put James Bradley's book in context. And I thought I might do that by touching on two or three of the sort of major big subjects that he deals with in the book. We'll leave it to him to tell you more of the actual story here in a bit. But first, race. The importance of race and race consciousness and what we would probably see today as racism in a pervasive way in American society and in the leadership class of the United States at the turn of the last century. Race is crucial, he suggests, in explaining and understanding not only why we got involved in the second big theme of the book, imperialism, in that same period of time. Most Americans, I think, now are very uncomfortable with the notion that the United States was imperialist. But I think most professional historians, at least, would agree now that it's absolutely undeniable that in roughly the last decade of the 19th century, surely the first of the 20th century, the United States did behave like an imperial power, just like all the others. We went to war with Spain. We took a colony in the Philippines. And again, without telling more of his story, that's the beginning of the trouble. The third thing that he touches on in an absolutely wonderful and delightful way is the life of Alice Roosevelt Longworth, Teddy Roosevelt's daughter, calling her the first celebrity of the 20th century. And the book has a lot of very interesting detail about who Alice was, how she behaved, how she was treated by the press. As I was reading it, I couldn't help but thinking of Tiger Woods. They had paparazzi then, and we've got them now. The last and major, I think, point of the book has to do with the question of, well, how did the United States and Japan end up going to war? Most people, in trying to answer that question, look at the 1930s or later. This book argues that the roots of that problem, that great collision between two great countries on opposite sides of the Pacific, has its roots in the same period of time when both were engaged in imperialism. And part of the big problem they had then was to try to figure out how to be friends and not collide in a war sooner than actually happened. I think when you take a look at this book, you will thoroughly enjoy it. It's very written in a very lively way. James has found some marvelous photographs which are very illustrative of this story, which is really a fascinating combination of sort of a tale of a journey around the Pacific, a cruise, and this high politics of how does the United States relate to Japan, how did Japan and the United States deal with the way in which things are changing as the 19th century turns into the 20th, and technology, commerce, and so forth bring them closer and closer together. That's probably enough from me. I think what we would hope we can do is get Mr. Bradley to talk more about the book, and maybe I'll be the one who sort of leads off here with a fairly obvious question, but I was struck when I started reading the book about really the sort of personal aspect of this, the story of how you get to this book. It's dealing with very different subjects than you've dealt with before. Certainly Flags of Our Fathers, this has that wonderful, very intense personal, you know, introduction of being on Iwo Jima. How did you come to 1905?
Well, you know, maybe I should stop now. You know, we're at a high point here. That was. Thank you for that introduction. You know, I'm usually out here on stage doing it myself. You know, so thank you. But my father was one of the guys who raised the flag on Iwo Jima. And after writing two books about World War II in the Pacific, I wondered about the source of that conflict, and were given Pearl Harbor as the explanation. And I looked at Pearl Harbor, and I thought, you know, the Pearl Harbor does not represent the invasion of the United States. The Japanese did not hit Pearl Harbor so that they could continue on to Los Angeles. They hit Pearl Harbor to disable the American military so that they could continue on with their game of expanding into Asia. And in thinking about it, I thought my father was not on Iwo Jima to protect his mother in Wisconsin from the Japanese taking over Milwaukee. He was on Iwo Jima to stop them from taking over Burma. It was Japanese expansionism in Asia that was the problem. So then I thought, where did this problem begin? And, you know, as Roger said, it's kind of gauzy. We all know that, well, Japan moved into China in the 30s and they were aggressive, and then Pearl Harbor and World War II. And I thought, when did Japan first make when did they first expand into Asia? And what was America's policy at that point, at the very beginning? What did we think about this, and what did we do or not do about it? And as I began to read, I discovered that in 1905, Theodore Roosevelt, bully president, newly elected, sends the largest delegation in the history of the United States to Asia. And it's a delegation not only headed by his own daughter, but by his assistant president, Secretary of War William Howard Taft, who was the anointed one who would become president in 1908. So this is a huge delegation full of senators, congressmen, whatever. And I thought, maybe I should take a look at this and see what happened. So 100 years later to the month, I went from San Francisco to Hawaii, Japan, Philippines, China, Korea, stood where they stood, and tried to get a perspective of what was going on here. And what I found shocked me, but that's how I got into it.
Okay. Why don't we talk a little bit about some of the main characters in your story? I think it would be fair to say, maybe I'm going a bit far in saying this way, do you really want to take Teddy down from Mount Rushmore? He has a very different and interesting view of Theodore Roosevelt as president and Theodore Roosevelt as sort of, you know, the secretary of, in effect, the secretary of state who runs his own foreign policy.
Well, I didn't set out with an opinion of Theodore Roosevelt other than the glorified opinion that image that I think he has in American history. I read Edmund Morris's Rise of Theodore Roosevelt in 1980 when it came out and read it again. I liked it so much. And so I wasn't circling around Theodore Roosevelt, and I did not set out to write a book about Theodore Roosevelt. But when they went on their imperial cruise, a big question then in 1905 was a question that we saw President Obama address today, and that is, why do we still have troops out in the Philippines? What's going there? We've been promised mission accomplished a number of times. Why are Americans still dying? Why are we spending money in the Philippines? And the explanation that President Roosevelt and Secretary of War Taft gave to the American public was, well, the Filipinos, see, we have to have patience because the Filipinos don't have the thousands of years of experience of self-government that we do. And and I read this. The first time I read it, I thought, we came from Greece or Rome or what, thousands of years. And I maybe thought it was a misprint. I didn't understand. And then I saw that in presidential communications to the public, look at Obama today. He has to break it down in the simplest possible logic to get it across to the populace. Well, President Roosevelt was talking about thousands of years that we have had democratic impulses, and I thought, how can he talk this way to the public? What is he talking about? Greek history? Well, I went back to what he learned in Harvard and what he learned in Columbia and what Taft learned in Yale, and I saw that this was racial history. I did not know myself that much of 19th century science was what I call scientists with no science. They could not plumb the depths of real science, so they had theories. One huge theory that underlaid most of college-educated people at that time was race theory. It wasn't racism. It was racial theory. And this racial theory kept rearing its head as I looked at the documents. So I didn't set out with a theme or a thesis, but this was how these guys were explaining American foreign policy to the American public at that time. And I'll get into China and Japan in a little later, I guess, in terms of racial theory.
Yeah, but I mean, it's a really crucial point, I think, in terms of the book, in terms of the story and the way that you're telling it. Do you think that this racial theory blinded the American presidents and leaders of the day, like even McKinley, Teddy Roosevelt's predecessor, to, hey, what are we getting into here when we send Commodore Dewey off there to Manila Bay to destroy the Spanish fleet so the Spanish ships won't be racing around the world and come back and shell New York or Jacksonville or something. Do you think they were really, caught up in this sort of racial theory?
They were. And I want to differentiate, the word racism didn't come about until the 1930s. So, No, I am not, and the book is not saying, here is an individual, Theodore Roosevelt or whatever, and he was racist. No, I was saying that there was a general understanding of the world in terms of racial history and racial theory. One racial theory that Roosevelt had was that China was a declining race. They were racially at the end, they were becoming impotent, as he would say, and they had lost their potency as a race. And this was a real thing, when a race was potent and when it was impotent. Well, China was now a declining race. So it was like a big barn caving in. And the only thing to be done with that Chinese landmass was for more potent races to take over. The most potent race in Asia were the Japanese, according to Roosevelt. They were the only ones who had militarized and industrialized. The Japanese said to Roosevelt, look it, we're an island country, and just as we're separate geographically from Asia, we're also separate culturally, and we're different. Look at Mr. Roosevelt. Look at those Chinese. They're still wearing ponytails and robes. We look at us Japanese from Tokyo. We go to Harvard, and we go to Brooks Brothers. We're different. We're assimilating Western culture, and you can trust us to be the ones to advance American culture into Asia. And Roosevelt writes in his own hand that you know he believed these theories.
Do you think they got in the way of trying to find a way out of or a way to fight that war that we did end up fighting, the war after the war in the Philippines? The war after the war with Spain and Cuba that turns into this
long insurrection,
rebellion, whatever you want to call it, but it's frankly, right. It's a mess.
Well, yeah, it was our first Vietnam. It was our first attempt at nation building. I went down to the Philippines 100 years after Theodore Roosevelt said mission accomplished in the Philippines, and I went down to the southern Philippines. I stumbled upon pictures of American soldiers waterboarding Filipino Muslims, and Filipino officials insisted, forced upon me, an armed police guard down in the Muslim part of the Philippines. 100 years after Roosevelt said mission accomplished, we still have troops fighting there. The Philippines were in the middle of their own independence revolution when America came to fight Spain there. Spain controlled the Philippines. But the Filipinos had their own very effective revolution going on. Many think they could have won if they had been left alone. And they welcomed America. They read the Constitution. They listened to American politicians. It was all about freedom and liberty and everything. And they said, you know, we're with you. They let the American army come in. But again, the racial theorists back in Washington never imagined that non-whites could take over. So we just replaced the Spanish, much to the shock of the Filipino revolutionaries, who then went out and fought Americans. And they haven't given up. We're still fighting.
Okay, but that's kind of the hinge that gets us involved with Japan in a way, isn't it? Wasn't one of the things that Teddy and Taft were worried about, well, gee, we've got the Philippines. We have the Philippines, quote unquote, but we don't have much of an army there. And Admiral Mahan tells us you can't divide the fleet, so we got to get the fleet out of there and get it back to the East Coast and the Atlantic where it belongs. Isn't the Philippines kind of in a way, the Pandora's box that opens that gets us to be more concerned about what Japan's doing?
First step towards Asia. The second chapter of the book is called Civilization Follows the Sun. And it's the white race came out of the Caucasus, that's why I'm called a Caucasian, and went to Germany and England and America. And so Roosevelt felt that America had to continue to go west. So the Philippines was part of that. It could have been any part of Asia, just so we were militarily throwing our power across the Pacific to what he called the other shore of the Pacific. And so we were in the Philippines. That was in 1898. In 1904, the Russo-Japanese War broke out. Now, in 1941 with Pearl Harbor, Franklin Delano Roosevelt condemned Pearl Harbor as a Japanese sneak attack. Hidden in history is that it was the second time Japan started a major war with a sneak attack. The first was against the Russians at Port Arthur, where they used tactics that were exactly like Pearl Harbor. When Theodore Roosevelt saw this sneak attack, he wrote to his son, I was thoroughly well pleased with the Japanese victory because the Japs are playing our game. What was the game? What was Roosevelt's game? This was the game. Roosevelt, in his Roosevelt corollary to the Monroe Doctrine, keeping everybody awake with this, you know, you know what the Monroe Doctrine is? It's that we get to control our part of the world. The Roosevelt corollary was we get to extend our police power. He's the first president who used the words police power, international police force. That's Theodore Roosevelt. And he said there's two parts of the world where we can use our police power. One is South America. The other one is North Asia. North Asia being the Russian Empire, Chinese Empire, Manchuria, and Korea. Roosevelt saw that as key to the future of the United States. And Congress would not fund troops. That lackadaisical, can't see the future Congress wouldn't step up to the plate and give Roosevelt the troops that he felt America should place in North Asia to have our place mark there. So he looked around, and the Japanese had a great military. He admired them. He said the Japanese are the most dashing fighters in the world. The suicidal tactics that we derided in World War II, Theodore Roosevelt thought were brilliant. He loved it. He really admired the Japanese military. And so he goes and makes a secret treaty in the summer of 1905 that gives Korea to Japan because Japan's going to be the placeholder for American civilization in North Asia. Again, a bunch of theories that didn't work out.
Yeah, I think part of that, wasn't it, this idea that he had that there was sort of, along with race theory, sort of a hierarchy of nations, and you could move up it. Well, the Japanese had moved up it. So, okay, they can take care of things in a way that we might want in Northeast Asia. He tried to, broker a peace settlement, which the Japanese wanted, with the Russians. So we kind of balance off the Russians and the Japanese and the Chinese and the British. But the Japanese are really the good guys here, which is, again, a little, I think, startling when we think we're so used to thinking the other way. But at this point in time.
That's a key point that you made about the hierarchy of races. Again, he went to Harvard and Columbia. He had these theories. Now he's in his 40s. And we think of Roosevelt as a great progressive. And he thought of this as a great progressive experiment. Mm-hmm. For the first time, an Asian country was going to take on the white man's burden. You know, you've got to go back to 1905. It was the mysterious Orient, and the West had come into Asia over the past few centuries, but Asia wouldn't move. You know, the Thais continued to look like Thais, and the Chinese continued to wear robes and have ponytails. I mean, they weren't with the program. And the Japanese were the only ones who militarized. They were the only ones who strung that telegraph wire and put in those trains and were wearing suits and were reaching out to the West and trying to learn from the West. So Roosevelt, in his theoretical whatever of hierarchies, saw the Japanese as an ascending race more like Americans than the rest of Asia. And these were the allies that were going to help America penetrate Asia. This was all on the sly. He won the Nobel Peace Prize for his activities in the summer of 1905. What the Nobel Peace Prize Committee never knew is that Roosevelt was acting as an agent of the Japanese. That's a strong word, agent of the. But he was the Japanese asked him to go to the Russians and say and pose as the honest broker between Russia and Japan. And he never told the Russians he was doing it at the behest of the Japanese. He told the world that it was his own idea. Then while they're at the negotiating table, he sends Taft out on this imperial cruise, and they wink, wink, agree, you know, we understand it's unconstitutional to have the president agree to a treaty, but why don't we do it anyway? And we would like Korea, and America says you can have Korea. So the problem in World War II that Franklin Delano Roosevelt had was Japanese expansionism, but it was greenlit, anointed, and approved by Theodore Roosevelt in the summer of 1905. Roosevelt closes the American embassy in Seoul and hands the keys over to the Japanese military to begin their expansionism. He tells the stunned Korean diplomats in Washington, you can't really talk to America anymore. You're not a country. 2,000 years, for 2,000 years you were a country, but you're not today. You're going to have to route your appeals through the Japanese Foreign Office in Tokyo.
Pretty big come down there, right? But I think it raises, the way you put that, it really raises an interesting question. How could Theodore Roosevelt, who some people said, okay, this is the most intelligent guy in the White House since Thomas Jefferson, how could he do this? And I want to ask you, part of Teddy's career that, catapults him to being president, vice president, and then president, of course, is the Rough Rider who goes off to Cuba to fight in Cuba. And supposedly the motivation for that, one of the reasons for that was, these Cubans have been revolting for a long time and it's bad for business and we got to have stability. And besides what we read in the newspaper, the Spaniards are butchering the women and children, all this stuff. There's a sort of moral benevolent aspect. I just wonder, a lot of people said the same sort of thing about the Koreans then. The Japanese did. Hey, the Koreans are... they're not with the program on this modernizing thing. They're more Confucian than Confucius. The country's backward. And besides, they're letting everybody and their brother in there, the Russians, the Chinese. It's just, we just got to, stabilize them, uplift them. How does Teddy, how do you think he really came to terms with this idea? Going along with it.
I think in his theoretical terms, again, Roosevelt, is looking from a Eurocentric 1905 Washington. It's the mysterious Orient. He's never, hardly ever met an Asian person, never been to Asia. We're not translating each other's books and newspapers. That was the mysterious Orient. So he deals with it theoretically. And his theory was that Korea was a dying race, was a small, dying race, an impotent race. He in his autobiography, he said they were impotent. They could not, they just didn't have the potency of a rising race where the Japanese did. So the Japanese should take it over. I think the book is also about the need to respect the fact that the founding fathers designed a system where the executive is not supposed to be making treaties with foreign countries and making big decisions for America without Senate oversight. What Roosevelt was doing was unconstitutional. So no matter how brilliant or not brilliant the president is, we have a system where we want the bright light of the Senate taking a look at his decisions. Roosevelt wrote, "I don't think the Senate's a good body for making treaties."
Well, he might have a point there, but this makes me think of another point I wanted to raise with you. I found it very interesting to think about. Reading your account of what goes on here, secret treaties, waterboarding, a war that starts one way and goes on and becomes something else, one damn thing leading to another. I kept thinking of the W. I mean, it's 2002. We know we're right, quote unquote. We got to have this war in Iraq. We got to get rid of that bad guy, and we're going to set him straight, and that'll be the model, and things will go great. And then it doesn't. But then it doesn't work that way, and we start to. Would you say when you were writing this that any of that ran through your mind? That parallels to now?
Definitely. When I was researching and writing about the Philippines, yeah. I'd look at the New York Times, and then I'd look at the. I'd look at the research and, get confused. I mean, we got a civilization, we just can't leave, and we're one more year, and if we have some more troops, and then, and mission accomplished. I mean, Roosevelt, in the book I say that I lost track of how many times Roosevelt said mission accomplished in the Philippines. It was, it would just go on and on. But the Philippines was our first experience at nation building. I go down there, and Bush had just been there. The President George W. Bush had just been to the Philippines the year before, and he gave a speech to the Philippines Senate about how this is America's, this is the first time America came to help a country be democratic. This is a good example. And people say we can't do it in Iraq, but look at this wonderful democracy in the Philippines. And, you know, we've got to stick it out in Iraq. Well, untold is that Bush came into Manila airspace. When he came in, he could see the pilots and two fighter planes. He could see their eyes. They were so afraid. They had fighter pilots on either side of Bush's plane as he came into Manila. They only let him stay for 8 hours. He couldn't sleep in the first democracy in Asia that America had set up because it was too dangerous. He was never allowed to go outside to see any Filipinos. So they flew him in this kind of iron security thing. He made a speech about how this is a wonderful democracy and Iraq will be like this someday. And then they hustled him back out through some tunnels and got him out of the Secret Service would not let the President of the United States spend the night in the Philippines.
We can't stop before we have Q&A from the audience, but a couple of words about Alice. Do you think that, I mean, Teddy consciously sent her to distract, you know, put the press off on what the real purpose of this might be?
It was a very imperial move. You know, it was a time of kings and queens, and Alice was gorgeous. You know, she was 21 years old. She was Princess Alice. And in America, if you said just the word Alice, everybody knew Alice Roosevelt. She would go to the horse races, and the horses would be going around the track, and everybody would be craning their neck to see Alice Roosevelt, and you wore Alice blue, and there were Alice dresses and Alice fashions, and there were Alice songs. And so she was the Jackie Kennedy of her day, and she kept the Roosevelt name alive as they went around Asia and allowed Taft to do all these secret dealings. But if you read the book and you are surprised by what you're reading, it mirrors the shock that I had in almost every port. I mean, I'm walking the streets of China and I stumble upon the source of Franklin Delano Roosevelt's wealth. I always assumed a guy with the last name Roosevelt, his dad was rich. Well, Franklin Delano Roosevelt's father was a well-off farmer, but he wasn't wealthy enough to support the lifestyle that Franklin Delano Roosevelt had. Manhattan townhouses, yachts, you know, and didn't make a lot of money himself. Well, the source of Franklin Delano Roosevelt's fortune was that Grandpa Delano, Warren Delano, had been the opium king of China. It was drug sales, illegal drug sales. Grandpa Delano was the biggest drug dealer in China and brought the money home. Franklin Delano Roosevelt grew up in the living room of Warren Delano under a portrait of this guy named Hokwa, who was reputed to be the wealthiest man in the world because he was the biggest Chinese opium dealer. And that's who Warren Delano dealt with. If you go to Low Library at Columbia, the library, you know, if you become president of Columbia tomorrow, they're going to photograph you in front of Low Library. Low Library is dedicated to a friend of Warren Delano's who made his fortune in China dealing opium. The Skull and Bone Society, you know, you all know who's the Skull and at Yale. That is paid for by the Russell family. Warren Delano worked for the Russell Delano for the Russell family. They were the biggest opium dealers in China. John Green, the first benefactor of Princeton, sold opium with Warren Delano in China. So these huge fortunes in the early 19th century that bankrolled Alexander Graham Bell, Ralph Waldo Emerson, you know, just on and on and on, came from the number one most profitable thing to do in the world at that time was to sell opium to the Chinese, which was illegal. So there's the book's full of surprises, and
yeah, it is. Oh, some wonderful surprises. But one last point, almost the last word in the books. You very modestly talk about how you, after the success of your previous books, established the James Bradley Foundation to send American high school students to China and Japan to maybe trying to bridge the gap, do away with this mysterious Orient idea? Could you tell us a little bit about that? How is it going?
Well, I wrote about a lot of mayhem out there in the Pacific and wondered what I could do about it. And for the past 10 years, we've been sending American high school kids to Japan and China. The idea is if you take one of these mushhead high school kids and send their mushhead out and they live for 1 year with a Chinese or Japanese mother, they might come back, and when they mature and age and go up into the power structure, next time we're thinking whether we should fight it out or talk it out, maybe one of them might make a difference.
Hey, that's a great idea. On that point, why don't we let you folks do some of the talking? If you have a question, why don't you just raise your hand, and there's somebody that's coming around with a mic, I guess, or do you want to try it without the mic?
I'll repeat the question.
Okay, do you want the lady here?
Yeah, I have a loud voice, so. I was so intrigued with what you had to say regarding the fortunes made with opium sales. I had a two-fold question. One, do you think that this is currently going on with the surge of poppy, that American interests might still be seeking profit from the poppies while they want control of Afghanistan, not just oil interests? And the other thing that it occurred to me is that these people might not want to just restrict their sales to the Chinese. Were any of them making money by selling opium in the U.S.?
Did everybody hear that, or you need it repeated? You heard it?
Everybody got it?
I think we risk taking this a little. There was no United States government support of these guys selling opium. This was all private business. They took off from the East Coast. They were seafarers. They were merchants. And there was a lot of money to be made selling opium illegally. And they went out and did it individually. The United States government didn't oppose it. Almost all the, we didn't have ambassadors back then. They were called consuls. Almost all the consuls to China were opium dealers for decades. When Commodore Perry sailed to Japan to open up Japan, he sailed along the Chinese coast and he stayed in opium dealers' mansions, you know. So it was known, but it wasn't supported by the U.S. government.
Yes, a gentleman here.
Right down here.
Right down here in the sort of second from the rear row in the first.
The handsome season. Guy.
What did President Roosevelt himself describe publicly as the purpose of the cruise of William Howard Taft and the others? How did he publicly describe its purpose?
Everyone heard that? William Howard Taft made his name as governor of the Philippines. At this point, he was Secretary of War. The House of Cards was collapsing, as it always does when we try to nation build. So it was time to go out and knock some heads out in Manila. And Taft had the idea of bringing along key senators and congressmen. There were no congresspeople. Congressmen on various committees to take a look. In the meantime, they had to stop in Hawaii. They had to stop in Japan. That was the route. So while they were stopping in Japan, why not show our friendship with Japan? And they had a number of ceremonies. And then they did China and Korea on the way home. The Philippines was the key. That was our Vietnam at the time.
Yes, anyone else? A gentleman there in the back row.
What was the attraction of the Philippines? Why did we want it?
Well, you know, now you've got about an hour and a half answer coming up to really get into it. But one key way to look at it is this. You know, why in the United States, we still have some towns named Fort This and Fort That, right?
Yeah.
Well, what we did, we had a population center in the east, and then we would, and then there'd be an army fort. And that army fort would take care of all the problems around, and that grew into a city. But it was connecting forts, you know, this fort to that fort is how we civilized the West. Now we needed islands to get across the Pacific. We needed coaling stations in the 19th century. So it was the U.S. Army handing the baton to the U.S. Navy to continue to expand. There was one empire that was crumbling, and it was the Spanish Empire. And they had some assets. They had Cuba, which would allow us to make the Caribbean an American lake. And they also had Guam and the Philippines. We weren't going to attack the British at Hong Kong. We weren't going to take on the country of Japan. But this sinking empire, Spain, this weak empire that was having revolutions in both the Philippines and Cuba, by hitting just the Spanish, all of a sudden we had the links to siphon the riches of China into the east coast of America.
Right. Yes.
It took me about 2 years to figure that out. I'm serious.
When Howard Taft was governor of the Philippines, I know he went there and he was an anti-imperialist. When did he transition to start following Roosevelt and believe in imperialism? Because when he first went there, there was a lot of atrocities, as you said, and there was a letter sent, and I know Roosevelt had kind of covered up what had happened, and there was a general that he went after, but he kind of backed off. How did Taft change from being anti-imperialist to an imperialist?
Well, I would say that the anti-imperialist part of Taft's life was maybe a public relations projection and a historical interpretation, because President McKinley needed to put a civilian face on this military operation. Taft's father had been Secretary of War, had been an ambassador. Taft was a known entity. He had served in Washington as Solicitor General. So McKinley calls him in, says, I want you to go out to the Philippines. And Taft saluted. And he went out there. And when you talk about race theory, read the letters that Taft wrote immediately when he got there. He said, these people will need at least a century of tutelage before they can even begin to understand what the concept of Anglo-Saxon liberty even is. He knew that within 1 week. He gets off the ship in the Philippines, and within 1 week, these people need at least a century of tutelage before they can understand Anglo-Saxon liberty.
But you know, you're making a really interesting point there. Whether it's Teddy Roosevelt or McKinley, they're turning to the experts, quote-unquote, of their day, just like President Obama is trying to figure out what the heck do we do or not do in Afghanistan. And one of the things I think you kind of suggest in a way is, wow, look where these experts can get you. Anybody else have a question? Yes, gentleman over here.
I had just recently read about the waterboarding, was not aware of that. And apparently that was quite a big issue in the day, caused quite a controversy. My question is, given that and all this other thing, it seems like we should have a Secretary of History on the cabinet. Because do you think historical amnesia is an American trait or a human trait?
Did everyone hear the question? You know, I got a D in German in my freshman year at Notre Dame, and it's amazing how it never made it onto my resume when I went when I applied for jobs later, you know? And I guess that's a cover-up, and I wasn't applying for jobs that were specifically asking about German. But I left that fact off my resume. So we tend to do that. And the wars we lost, I don't know, you can go to the Vietnam Memorial, and it's very emotional to see those 54,000 names. I can't see the names of the guys who sent them there and what we were doing there. And how come Johnson and McNamara, before almost all of those guys died, had a telephone conversation that is recorded, I've heard it, and you probably know about it, how, you know, well, we're never going to win there this way, and yeah, well, I'm not going to be. And Johnson's talking about, you know, we'll send in the troops, but this is a sinkhole. And how come those guys' names aren't there and the whole story isn't told? It's just a grieving place. We don't tell that whole, we lost in Vietnam. We don't tell that whole story. Why am I able to present in this book many facts that that I never knew before? I don't know, and it bothered me a lot. And I wonder about how we teach ourselves. But I think all countries leave their bad grades on the floor, on the cutting room floor, and they want to proceed with the national myth. And, you know, the New York Times, in two different articles about this book, has called the Theodore Roosevelt biographers besotted and said that they subscribe to certain orthodoxies and they have just avoided a lot of the material that I present in the book. It was there. It was hidden history because we just wanted that to be somewhere else in another layer. So I'm not answering your question real well. I don't think it's just an American problem. I think it's human nature. You know, Iwo Jima is a big deal in American history, and you can see the picture, and there's, go on the internet and look up the word Iwo Jima. I didn't put the 300,000 references to it up, you know. There were three movies made about the flag raising before Clint Eastwood made the movie of my book, three movies about Iwo Jima, right? If you go to Japan, they, No. And then they look a little in the history and they, oh, that's Gyokusai, you know, that's where everybody died. I mean, they had 22,000 deaths there. So Iwo Jima is just something that they had difficulty talking about. So it's not hidden, but.
Mm-hmm. Yes, a gentleman here.
Could it be that when we got to a certain point in the Philippines, we decided it was smart to say, you'd be independent by 1941 and give up and go. But we should have done other wars. In other words, we thought it was so fruitless, we'd say, okay, we're going to create a country for you in 1941 and you're on your own, goodbye.
Well, do you mean, so we went into the Philippines in 1898, and you're saying, I don't see the 1941 thing. We could have, in 1898, we could have said, hey, you Spaniards get out, you Filipinos can run your own country. With the Philippines?
We said enough, you know.
We did in 45 or 48?
Well, actually we started with this sort of transition to that in the middle of the 1930s.
That's right.
But we were going to, they did become independent.
You promised in 41 they'd be their own country.
Right.
But how, you know, I mean, are we supposed, so we're supposed to nation build beyond 50 years in some place?
No, no.
I mean,
We did it, went as far as we could go, and we said, okay, we've done what we can do, good luck.
When we were ramping up to invade Iraq, people, I was out talking about my second book, and people would ask me what I thought, and I asked audiences, and I'll ask you, can you give me an example where a major nation invaded another large nation, and it worked out? Japan and Germany are not examples. If we had invaded Japan or Germany in 1934, let's say, I think we'd still be fighting in the Japanese or German Alps, you know? But where has a country invaded another country, the large countries, and that has worked out? I don't understand how if Mexico invaded and took over L.A., I would think a lot better of tacos if the Mexican military was surrounding this building. I mean, I wouldn't think of, you know, even if the Chinese troops were here to give us the benefit of their 5,000 year civilization, I wouldn't like it. And you know, you laugh, but tonight Americans are believing that if 30,000 American troops surround people that they cannot communicate with, that those people are going to think this is great. And that's a belief in America somehow, or else the president wouldn't be able to do that. So where are these historical examples where this has worked out?
Yes.
Would you say the last example would be the Russian war. I mean, they get Roosevelt to come in and broker there to broker the peace agreement for, anyway, wouldn't an example of that be when the Japanese invaded?
No, sir. I said when Japan didn't invade Russia and Russia didn't invade Japan unilaterally.
Okay.
I'm just
Manchuria?
Saying. No, a better example is Russia going into all when it made the Soviet Union, it invaded all those whatever. Hitler going into France. The French didn't think, you know, let's get rid of baguettes and get on to Wiener Schnitzel here. people, we're laughing, but this is $1 million per soldier going into Afghanistan with the bet that a nation is going to be built. And I've been all across the country asking for, give me 5 successful examples where this has happened. And, anyway.
Yes, the gentleman right here in the front row.
Hi, I live in Manila Bay, so this is really great.
You live in Manila?
Yeah, I look over where Dewey set up the battle with the Spanish. Great stories, thank you. Do we have to redefine what mission accomplished really is? What is victory to these guys who are drug dealers? Our elite. What does mission accomplished mean now, really, to those people?
You know, part of mission accomplished or victory could be the largest part of the United States successfully commandeering almost 40% of the United States federal budget. That's a very large victory. And then putting into place a cash flow. We will, you know, there will be a huge cash flow around Iraq for generations. So.
That's intriguing you say that, because one of the more intriguing arguments about the Japanese and the Japanese army in this period that has to do with what gets us into Pearl Harbor eventually is that that's exactly what they wanted. They're battling the Navy for money. They're losing. So, okay, if we got this colony to develop in Korea on the mainland, we need a big army and we need a big budget. And you lily-livered politicians, whatever, need to vote for it. And, of course, give us a chance to succeed in modernizing the Korea. Yeah, I think we have time for one or two more questions. Anyone? Yes, lady way in the top row there.
Yeah, I arrived late, so I might have missed something. Wasn't one of the first stepping stones east Hawaii?
You mean west?
Yeah.
For America?
Well, over to the...
You have a bit to say about Hawaii.
Orient.
Yeah, the Imperial cruise stopped first in Hawaii. That was our first. That was our first exam. I realized when I went to research this, it was the first example of regime change. Hawaii was a separate country. It was the Kingdom of Hawaii. The first royalty to visit Washington was a king of Hawaii. The Hawaiian Palace in downtown Honolulu had electricity and toilets before the White House. I mean, they weren't sitting around the campfire. And in 1893, in the first example of American regime change, the American ambassador to a separate country, the Kingdom of Hawaii, ordered the Marines off a Navy ship who marched to the palace and surrounded it and took out their bayonets and asked the Queen to leave. And so it was the first example of regime change. That's why I learned that in 1905, when Alice Roosevelt visited, no native Hawaiians came out to greet her.
On that happy note, I hate to have to bring this to a close, but I think James Bradley has certainly whetted your appetite to want to buy a copy of The Imperial Cruise. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Roger. Thank you.
Thank you so much for coming today. And there are books for sale in the lobby, and Mr. Bradley will be happy to sign them for you. And if you enjoyed tonight's Aloud program and wish to support Aloud, please do drop your donation in the jar in the lobby or consider becoming a library associate. We appreciate your support of our programs. Thank you for coming.
Thanks. Thank you, Roger. That was fun.
Really?
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Annenberg Foundation, City National Bank, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, Donna and Martin J. Wolf, and the law firm Arendt Fox. Media support provided by KPCC 89.3 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and KCET. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.